Hey, stranger, you're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the You and My Discography podcast, a show where a You and My fan and a You and My super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waits, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the You and My fan in the equation. My co-host and You and My super fan is Sydney Sider, John O'Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. John O, how the bloody hell are ya?
I'm feeling John O'Duncan, Tom. How about yourself, mate?
Yeah, I'm feeling Tommy Waite. And that's actually very fitting for this. We're feeling self-titled versions of one another. I see what you did there. I thought you'd been original and unique, but no, you're riffing on the episode. So as John has alluded to, today in episode 9, we're talking UMI, the self-titled LP by UMI from 2010. Before we get stuck into the record, our regular disclaimer. Myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as UMI. But if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you seem like a man who spends thousands of hard-earned buckaroos installing state-of-the-art surveillance cameras in your living room, then inviting all your droogies around for a couple whiskey sours and a casual game of Monopoly, purely so you can comb through the footage the next day to ensure that no one was dipping into the bank to fund their over-leveraged portfolio of properties. What I'm trying to say is that Jono Duncan is a man who likes to do things by the book. So, with that being said, how do you think this disclaimer holds up from a legal perspective?
Yeah, look, I feel a bit like I'm trying to think of a character like Steve Urkel or something. You paint me as like a bit of a dweeb, but I think we're safe. I got my pants up above my belly button.
Yeah, I think the audience can probably gather that there's a bit of creative liberty each week I'm taking with this painting. Painting the picture of John O'Duncan, but the main thing is that we're not affiliated to UMI. We just like them a lot, man. Yeah. All right, so the format for the show will be the same as usual. To kick things off, we'll talk about what led up to the recording of the album. Then we'll go through the record track by track. Finally, we'll talk about what happened after the album dropped, give out gold, silver, bronze medals for the tunes on the record. To kick things off, Jono, why do you reckon they went with self-titled for this LP?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, I think the thing about choosing the title for your album, you know, be it self-titled or something else, is that you can perhaps set the narrative with the music press, I think. But perhaps before I get to that, I think last week I mentioned how in the first 8 UMI records, each new album had been a pretty stark departure in vibe compared to its predecessor. Well, number 9, self-titled, is a kind of change in that there isn't as distinct a change from Dilettantes. Instead, I'd say this record feels like more of a progression rather than a departure. And we discussed last week how Dilettantes starts pretty somber and eventually ends on a note of understanding and hope. And my sense is that this record continues on that vibe that we finished on with Dilettantes. There's more optimism here. There's more of a quiet confidence, maybe a reflection of being more at peace with things. And I guess, you know, being more calm and serene about your surroundings helps you look at things more objectively and more as an observer. And it probably also feeds into a more inquisitive and generous approach to subject matter. And I really like the way this record builds. It starts in a really thoughtful and interesting way, but as it progresses, it gradually loosens up and becomes more buoyant. Even Let's Not Get Famous near the end, while it slows the tempo, has a lightness to it. And I get the feeling that the band enjoyed exploring the subtleties of their sound during the Dilettantes sessions and wanted to dig a bit further with this record. And the result, I think, is a bit more of a cohesive listening experience compared to Dilettantes, whereas Dilettantes maybe jumped around a little bit. This record feels like it flows a bit better. The self-titled thing, you know, it's an interesting one for the ninth album. the narrative that I remember at the time was that they considered that more than any other record before, this felt like UMI and no one else. Like, you know, every young band, they wore their influences on their sleeves early on. And then I guess there's a process of cultivating what they considered to be a definitive UMI sound. And so for the band, maybe this was the culmination of that process at the time. And maybe that was one reason among many, no doubt, that they didn't make another record together for another 5 years. Maybe they felt comfortable in the knowledge that they'd reached the conclusion of a process, the process, you know, which had its challenges as we've kind of been through. And they didn't feel the itch to get back in the studio for a while. That's just me joining some imaginary dots, but I'd like to think there's something in that. And so anyway, I think it's a strong record and it gets stronger as it progresses. I really like it. I'm keen to know your thoughts, Tommy, because I know you had some misgivings about Dilettantes. And as I said, I think this, for me, continued along similar lines. So curious to know what you thought.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot with what you said. And yeah, not to bury the lead, I think this is the stronger record compared to Dilettantes. But I agree in that it's more of a continuation as opposed to a massive departure from Dilettantes. And so, yeah, it was good for me to listen to them back to back because I kind of saw the similarities and perhaps some of the differences, which we'll get to. And yeah, for me, self-titled, yeah, this is something that used to annoy me a lot as a younger man, where I was like, lazy. Come on, guys. Yeah, you figured out your band name. And, you know, that was actually something I also wanted to bring up in that we'd never really touched on why the obligatory music journal question, how'd you get your band name? And it kind of blew my mind because I think it was only last year or something that I read that UMI came from, I think it was like one of the very early gigs. Then Tim was talking to someone, it was like a hippie guy, and the sentiment was basically like, I am you, but backwards. Is that the origin story of the band name? Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. He was talking to some dude and he was getting a bit spiritual, and I think he maybe had a t-shirt or something that said, I am you, and then he was saying, I am you, UMI, and that kind of, that became the band name and kind of stuck.
Yeah. So yeah, as a younger, I'm glad that that's, we got to the bottom of that. But yeah, as a younger man, the self-titled thing used to annoy me. As I've gotten older, I've mellowed, and I agree. I think for this one, it's kind of, what you said in terms of like, this is the UMI sound, but I also think it's just kind of like an acceptance of like, oh, this is who we are. This is what we do. And we're not going to try and pretend to be anyone that we're not. And I also kind of, perhaps I'm again connecting some imaginary dots here, but the cover of the LP with like the shape of Australia, but with like some, I don't know what you'd even call it. It looks kind of like it's being set alight or something, or there's some weird wonkiness to it, but it's kind of like, for me at least, what I get out of it is like, this is who we are. This is where we're from. This is what we do. So, no bullshit kind of vibe, and an acceptance of who they are as a musical rock and roll combo.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm looking at the cover right now. I've never actually noticed that it does have a similarity to the shape of Australia. There you go. Yeah. I just thought it was kind of just a lovely piece of art, but there you go. But in terms of the self-titled thing, yeah, like I said, it could be an element of just trying to set the narrative with the music press. I mean, by this point in time, they'd made 8 or 9 records over 20 years together. They'd done a million interviews. They knew how the whole kind of street press shebang worked. They knew, you know, a lot of journos will focus on the title of the album because, you know, they have to get copy out and they need to fill space. And so for a band in UMI's position, it's probably an easy way to control the message. So instead of journos going, this is just a continuation of Dilettantes, they're saying, hey, so why self-titled on album 9? And then it becomes almost a you know, a message of renewal and rebirth instead of just continuation. You know, this is the first album where it really feels like us. Wow, you know, another comeback, or you know, the press love a comeback and tell us again about the time when you kind of broke up but you didn't. Yeah, so I'm a bit the same. I've never been a huge fan of self-titled albums, and not that it's a hill that I'd die on, but you know, in general, I would like to see a name for a record. And you know, when you're naming a record, you know, you've got like 11 or 12 songs to choose from as well. Like often you can just choose a song from the album that's emblematic of the sound. But no, I guess in this case it does make sense. They at that time they'd been through a process, they felt totally comfortable in their own skin, so it does make sense to just go, you know what, this is us, it's self-titled.
Yeah, I've always thought that the kind of like ultimate masterstroke with the marketing is bands who've self-titled an album. For I guess the most obvious example being like the White Album by the Beatles. Oh, but yeah. Then it takes on this like mystic quality when it's like, oh, it's the White Album. It's like that's pretty cool when like the world yep. names it for you almost. But again, yeah. That's probably concocted by a few kind of Don Drapers in suits in a meeting room somewhere, as opposed to anything more artistic or creative or organic.
Well, we could call this album Australia.
Australia one. Yeah, let's get it trending on the Googles. All right, well, that's enough preamble. Let's jump right in. Track one. We hardly knew you. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, one of the great thing about Tim's songwriting is that he can do observational, he can do narrative, although he doesn't really do straight narrative that much, but he can also do poetic and esoteric. And so this song probably fits somewhere in between those two. What's it about? Don't really know. The title gives us a hint. Maybe someone's passed away. The first line mimics the Declaration of Independence. Is that significant? Probably not. But you could argue that it's a statement of their independence from others' opinions, maybe. But that is probably a stretch. Maybe it's just an artistic flourish. But whatever it's about, it grapples with some really interesting subject matter. You know, how can you march so blissfully on knowing everyone loved is on loan? How could you not march blissfully on knowing everyone loved is on loan? To me, that's asking some, you know, pretty big questions about how to approach life. In some ways, you know, life is mundane and repetitive. In others, it's glorious and full to the brim and, you know, precious and fragile. And so how do you approach life and love when you know, on the one hand, that all that you love could disappear in an inkling, but on the other, you know that all that you love is also all the stuff that brings you heartache and headaches. And, so I just kind of got me thinking, you know, oh, life's so mixed up when you think about it, and it's no wonder people prefer not to think about it too much. So musically, I like how the song brings the heat towards the end. It's quite a searing moment. But just like as we discussed in Dilettantes, there is a part of me that's like, oh, here we go, it's about to take off, and then it's kind of done. But, you know, I do respect the restraint and what they're going for here. So, yeah, interesting start to the album.
Yeah, I really like this track. From the jump, and to kind of pick up on what I was saying before, I just like, I can't really decipher whether it's like Tim's delivery of his vocals or the way it was recorded. I think it's a bit of both, but I prefer it much more to the way it was done on Dilettantes. I just think his voice sounds a lot better in the mix. And the production on this song is amazing. I'd say that like the first half is almost kind of like Pink Floyd, you know, that French band Air, that type of territory where it's like late night headphones music. Where you can really just kind of immerse yourself in the sonic landscape. And I think it's a kind of like a very beautiful way to start to kind of like drift into the album, I'd say. The lyric, on loan, where it ends on loan, can you repeat that?
Yeah, how can you march so blissfully on knowing everyone loved is on loan? And then yes. How can you not march blissfully on, et cetera?
Yeah, so that I remember liking that when the first came, but remembering that lyric when it first came out and it sticking with me, and then kind of revisiting it now and through some of the books, the book I wrote and the something I'm working on now, I've done some digging into the manosphere guides online where it's like giving losers advice about how to get laid and get a girlfriend and stuff like that. Right. They've got this it's a weird part of the internet, but they've got this expression where it's like, she's not yours, it's just your turn. And essentially, as in like, which is pretty insidious, but like, don't trust the person you're with. And I guess you could spin that to be like, be the best version of yourself to keep them around. But I was thinking about this line in terms of like, everyone's love is on loan, and it's kind of like similar sentiment in a sense where things can drift and things can change, and you shouldn't take things for granted. I feel like the UMI, or the, I guess Tim Rogers lyrics, this particular lyric is way more thoughtful, poetic version. But it kind of struck me as a kind of like a similar type of thing where, you can be unsure of yourself and things can change. But yeah, in terms of trying to figure out the meaning of the song, it's kind of seems a little esoteric. But yeah, we hardly knew you in terms of who's the we. Is that everyone that you have dated in the past? And you've drifted apart, but either way, I think it's an amazing way to start the album and kind of ask the big questions.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, we hardly knew you. I guess suggests that someone's passed away. So on a basic level, it's like someone that, you know, a family member or a loved one passed away, and it kind of makes you think when that happens. Yeah, it's just so everything's so fleeting and temporary that people come in and out of your life. It could be in a flash of the inkling, what is it? A winkling of the eye or a tinkling? I don't know, you know, in a flash.
One of those, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but good start to the record.
All right, so track two, we go into Kicking the Balustrade.
Yeah.
John, what are your thoughts?
I'm interested in this song and the sequencing of this song. So throughout our listening journey through the records, you and I will generally place their strongest or most rockin' or most emblematic song of the record as the second track. That's my sense from going through it so far. To me, though, this song is probably none of those, which makes it an interesting choice. Either they think it's one of the strongest tunes, which is cool, or they're approaching things differently. And I wonder if it's the latter. I guess it plays a role in the flow of the album. It definitely helps set the foundation for the album to build from. And, you know, not a bad tune at all. It's a good tune. The line, "You've just been portrayed by love, may you always be conveyed by love," is a hopeful line, I think, that, you know, probably reflects the sentiment that spills over from the end of Dilettantes. You know, things aren't perfect, but, you know, I'm choosing silver linings. So, yeah, interesting one.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of this song. I agree, kind of bucks the trend. A little different to the prior records. And I think they're actually quite similar songs, both track one and two here.
Yeah.
And this one has got kind of the build up. And then kind of like it lets loose a little more in the second half. I love a few of the lines. The intervention will not go as planned. Which I think if the intervention goes as planned, you probably didn't need to do an intervention. is my thinking there is that like the person they seem like pretty much under control if you can predict what's going to happen. So that's cool. And then I think the standout line is "Loose as a real estate suit." We might be showing our age here, but like me and Jono grew up in the era where real estate agents wore ill-fitting suits. They could often be quite attractive, gregarious people, complete failures in every other aspect of their life, but they could be quite good at selling real estate. But I found nowadays, I'm not sure if it's because of that fucking show, Selling Sunset or Instagram or what the deal is, but I found that like real estate agents don't wear ill-fitting suits anymore. They're actually extremely well put together and kind of like look like A-list celebrities. Yeah, no, I actually, there's some like, I think in because the Australian property market, particularly on the East Coast, is so insane. There are like legit celebs and they have like reality TV shows over there now. So I was like, you won't catch any of those modern day real estate agents in loose suits. But
If celebrities celebrities sometimes do become real estate agents. Like I'm thinking Bruce Samazan. Some of the football players after they retire, I know of a few that become real estate agents. So like, yeah, it's a different vibe and scene to when we grew up, that's for sure.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess just in terms of the kind of takeaway that there does seem to be kind of like some sadness here and the line you mentioned, you've just been betrayed by love. May you always be conveyed by love. I've been reading this. I haven't read the book, but there's a new biography coming out about Anthony Bourdain, about his final days. And the kind of the bullet points there are that he had this tumultuous relationship with this Italian actress lady, and she was apparently like screwing around on him towards the end. And I guess probably just because that was fresh in my mind, and then I listened to this song, it just kind of made me feel like the weariness you must feel as you get older, where you have been around the block, but yet your emotions can still mangle you. That must get tiring. And I think, you know, I guess I'm extrapolating directly because this Tony Bourdain thing was fresh in my mind, but, that's just the kind of, it seems kind of like there's a bit of hope, but there's a lot of sadness kind of mixed in as well with this track.
Yeah, right. Well, that's interesting. Every time I hear this track from now on, I probably will think of Anthony Bourdain, which is not a bad thing.
But I should also planted the seed.
You planted the seed. Should also mention before we forget, this record was the third in a row produced by Greg Wales. So he also produced Convicts and Dilettantes. And so we're now into the third in a row where he has produced his self-titled one as well.
All right, so let's move on. Track 3, Lie and Face the Sun. Jono, you're a man who appreciates a bit of vitamin D. What are your thoughts?
Oh, sure do. Look, welcome to UMI, Megan Washington. One way, it's a song about letting go a little and appreciating your surrounds, but you could also read it as maybe a coming out song for Tim and Megan as a couple. I'm not sure if Tim and Megan were ever actually an item. I know they hung out for a bit. I think Tim's wiki page suggests that they went out for a while, but I don't know if that's true. But yeah, some of the lines are come on as if anyone could know. And if so, it's just our cover blown. It could be about them. It could be just about a random couple. Maybe it's the couple in Kathy's Clown. The remaining lyrics could be read along the lines of, you know, let's give this a go and see where it takes us. It's a nice tune. I think the tempo is perfect. I like the interplay between Tim and Megan, particularly towards the end. You know, you're insane. You're my hero too. You know, we should hang for what we do. I want to believe it. I want to believe it. It's quite a lovely song.
Yeah, for me, this one, I guess when I was living in Perth, I was lucky enough to live in a very nice part of town called Mosman Park, or as the locals like to call it, Mozzie Park. And it's in the western suburbs, nice part of town, but I lived in the dodgy little corner near the kind of council houses. But there was this, it's filled with all these retired boomers. And there was, when you come back from Cottesloe Beach, or if you nip down to the Cottesloe shops, you'd cross Stirling Highway, and there was some shop there. I'm not 100% sure what they sold. Really expensive things for boomers, like paintings or photographs. Like, I had no reason to go into the shop ever. I'd walk and drove past it many times, but they had this quote printed on the outside, which reminds me of this song. It says, "Ah, summer. that long anticipated stretch of lazy, lingering days, free of responsibility and rife with possibility. And me and the miss, I used to laugh about it because we were like, that's what cashed up boomers who did well with negative gearing in the 90s, probably just like, oh, 40 more years of this. Isn't this great? Just kind of frolicking about their 6x3 mansions, which they only use four rooms at most. And so anyway, for me, this particular song, if I was young and in love, I reckon I could get into it, but it just kind of doesn't do it for me because I'm not really in that state of mind. Similar, like just like the boomer quote, I'm kind of like, yeah, maybe I'll get there if I'm very lucky. I'll get out of the dodgy part of Mozzie Park and into one of those juicy big 6x3s. But yeah, no, for now, I'm just looking at it from the outside and go, huh, they're enjoying that, but not me. So that's
right.
Kind of how I think track three.
Okay. Well, you planted the Anthony Bourdain thing for track two, and now whenever I listen to this song, I'll be thinking of Cottesloe Boomers. So thanks, Tom.
I need to keep my mouth shut a little bit. I'm changing the narrative here a bit too much. So no. Oh yeah, I'm looking ahead of my notes here. I'm changing the narrative a lot on this particular record. So
this is the risk it's a self-titled, isn't it? This is the risk that they take.
Exactly.
Letting us set
FTK,
the narrative.
FTK from a few records ago. They should have brought that title back. And yeah. All right. But so that's track three. Track four, The Good Ones, Jono.
This is a sweet tune. I think a lot of people might resonate with. Definitely does for me. It seems to be about a guy who is enamored with a lovely lady that can't bring himself to actually tell her lest he scares her away. Now, instead, he's essentially becoming the woman's helper. He's changing light bulbs, checking mains. He's bringing bakery treats and sliced deli meats. Meanwhile, I'm guessing the woman is thinking, oh, that's nice. But she has no real inkling or maybe doesn't want to know about this guy's true feelings. You know, for her, it's a little weird. It's a little sweet, but he's harmless and nice enough. And he's helping around the house. And it seems like the feelings he has for her will probably never be consummated. But the thing is, he knows deep down there's never really a possibility anyway because he's never had much luck in love. And so any interaction with this graceful, funny, you know, beautiful woman is like a gift. You know, you gave him the moment money just can't buy. The good ones may finish last. They need no other prize. That's my take. Am I reading too much into this and projecting from my previous life experience? I don't know. I'll let the listener decide. No prizes. No prizes. But, you know, it could be, you know, the phenomenon of the friend zone. It could be, you know, along those lines. You know, you fall for this amazing woman. She's probably out of your league. But you've got enough basic charm or quirk to keep her attention. But you take the attention more out of hope than anything as a sign that maybe if all the stars align, if every single card falls a certain way, things could work out. You know, human beings can convince ourselves of anything with even the flimsiest evidence. So to keep her attention and to keep yourself relevant, you start doing little favors. Yeah, I'll check your mains. And, you know, your friends are like, you have no idea what mains are. I was like, yeah, I always check mains. What are you talking about? And, you know, I'm always baking bakery treats. You essentially become a low-level servant just to keep the dream in your mind alive. And it takes something brutal to shake you into reality. Like seeing her pashing the office hunk or actually being directly told, this will never happen. Get away, Jono. But look, I'm just, you know, speculating really. Not about
me. Yeah, no, we're going to make sure it's not autobiographical for the rest of because of my faux pas. So thanks for sharing that completely objective bit of commentary for that one. Yeah, no, I like this one. This kind of reminds me a little bit. You mentioned Kathy's Clown before, just kind of the random storytelling of Tim's songwriting from the early records. It kind of reminds me of that where seems just slice of life type of thing. And yeah, the good guys may finish. The line is the good guys may finish last. They need no other prize. Is that it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Bill Burr joke where he was defending Tiger Woods and people when kind of the average man on the street would say, oh, it's absolutely reprehensible what he's doing. And he's like, I'm going to try and do a Bill Burr. Dude, how many Scandinavian tens are throwing themselves at you when you step out of your Toyota Camry, dude? So it's true. Yeah. It's easy to be a nice guy or a good guy when there's no possibility of being a bad guy. So, yeah, I think that's slightly not related, considering, as you mentioned, this just seems to be kind of like an actual genuinely good guy trying to, punch up. He's punching slightly and having a little fantasy. But, yeah, I like it because it's kind of a nice little story, slice of life ditty that reminds me of the earlier work. But, yeah, with a slightly different sound. So I dig it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're still building. I feel like the album builds. It's building. Yeah. It's building. So, yeah, it's a good sound and a good sequencing.
Track 5, Shuck, which is a great word by any stretch of the imagination. It's just fun to say. It's fun to look at. Track 5, Shuck. Jono, what are your thoughts?
It's got rhyming potential. Now, yes. This is the... the first
single. You're a fucking genius, mate. I never thought of that.
The first single from the record, From Memory, another sweet tune that errs on the positive, I'd say. You know, Shuck the past, my poise, the background noise, you know, shuck the ceilings from the walls. It's kind of like saying, let's take on this crazy world and embrace whatever comes. I also like the big pre-chorus into the big chorus. You know, once again, apologies if I'm getting my terminologies wrong, but you know, there's a lot of chorus and I like it. But yeah, it seems like a lush pop song that once again fits nicely into this part of the record.
Yeah, you kind of took the words out of my mouth there. The pre-chorus and the chorus are huge on this one. And I've got this theory where if you've got a huge pre-chorus and chorus, well then that's kind of all you need, right? So then your job as the songwriter and the guys in the band, what you have to do is kind of make every other part of the song as inconspicuous as possible, because everyone knows what's coming. Well, the first time you're like, oh wow, that got here really good. That pre-chorus is here already and it's great. And here's a chorus. And then once you step away from that first chorus, everyone's like, I know it's coming again. Let's get there as quickly and efficiently as possible. And I think Tim and the band do a great job of, just making it shine. So there's a song later in this record, which I think they kind of do the opposite and it doesn't work. Well, which I'll explain when we get to it. But I just think it's the underpinnings of Christian rock, if we're going to be honest. And I think this is Christian rock done right in the fact that it's not about anything religious. and the chorus is huge and catchy.
Right. Okay. So yeah, it's the kind of like song on the Saturday night service at 6:30 PM where the year 12s are in the back, you know, playing with the acoustic guitar and sort of, you know, swaying with each other.
Yeah, it's the big one. It's the one, the Hillsong, where they'll really kind of go full Scott Morrison and have a do some thrashing about on the floor, because this is the big number to send us home.
We should say that we like this song. Let's just reiterate that we like this song. We're not
I do. Yeah, no, I guess I'm just trying to say is that it's like. I guess it would be kind of a little bit rare for you or me to have a chorus this big.
Yeah.
But they've got some big chorus moments and some kind of like, some great riffage. But I think this is kind of like unprecedented in terms of like this. The whole song feels like a chorus in a good way.
Yeah, yeah.
And and I think the other parts of the song are kind of unmemorable, but they help in terms of showcase the very best part of it. So I think it's a songwriting masterclass. The lyrics are cool and exciting and big fan.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. And each part of the song plays its part to get to that bit. Like the lyrics are interesting. It's like telling a story of like kind of flirting with your French teacher or something. So the stuff that keeps you interested, and then the big chorus. So maybe like big unprecedented chorus might have been a good name for the album. I don't know. Like, this is all in hindsight. Unprecedented yeah. chorus by UMI. That could have been something. But yeah, great song. Shuck.
All right, track six, Crime. You're a man who doesn't stripe. You and Crime don't mix, Jono. But I think you can venture into the world of Crime to talk about this song if you feel comfortable.
Okay. Look, Tom, we haven't seen each other for 5 years, so you don't know what's been going on in my life for the last 5 years, my God. You don't know what I've been through. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. This is a slow burn for me, but I really like this tune. There's an element of darkness here, kind of alluding to similar themes in recent records, you know, maybe see Disappearing and By My Own Hand. But I feel like in this tune, there's a feeling of being past the worst of the feelings that got you so low. And the end jam here is, I think, spot on. A couple of times over the last couple of records, we noted opportunities that we thought songs might have exploded, but maybe didn't for whatever reason. You could say the same thing about this tune, but I actually think the outro jam is perfect for this song and how the album is unfolding to this point. So yeah, really, really, really rate it actually.
Yeah, I've gone full music journal to describe the outro as a sludgy groove. And hats off to Greg Wales with the production. The production is perfect on this track. I think there's no drums for the first half of the song, so I think that kind of was a good stylistic choice. It helps the build. And then I think by default makes the sludgy groove outro even sludgier and groovier. There's also kind of like just there's like a single note on a keyboard that gets like louder progressively towards the end, where it kind of has like the effect of an alarm getting slowly louder. And a few of the kind of lines jump out at me at the criminal end of my fuse. And the one I like the most is I was dancing, falling off the edge of the world. And I will make it by myself very briefly here, but a few years ago I met a bunch of my friends. There was like 14 of us in total in the Philippines. We met at this remote island, and it's one of those instances where like we all arrived kind of separately, like four people arrived and like next people. And so by the first night we're all there, had a big piss up on the beach. And then it was actually quite funny because we were all like in our mid-20s at that point, and this island we'd picked was very popular for like 40 50 something European divers. And as they heard Larry Australians get off the boat, there was an audible groan from them. They were like, oh Christ, this is gonna be a rough week. And so of course we went really hard on the first night. And then I just had this memory of myself. We were all sitting on the sand and I was walking around tapping on my friends on the head, like playing a game of duck, duck, goose, but no one else was playing. And I've been guilty of going a little too hard on vacations in the past, where you're in an exotic place. So you think you kind of have to act a bit more exotic, or like you're like, I think it's a part of your brain that gets tricked. And it's like, oh, this is my life now. I'm just going to wear a Hawaiian shirt and live on a beach and play duck, duck, goose with Ren. My friends will leave in a week, but I'll play with the European scuba divers. Who cares? And then you feel like a fool. You've realized, oh, I'm dancing, but I'm kind of having like a mini crisis here on holiday. So, that's the kind of vibes I get, particularly with the outro and the sound.
Well, on the key that sort of like repeated note there. So on the album here, I've got the CD casing here. It's UMI and it has Rusty, Andy, Davey and Tim, and then with Megan Washington, Laney Lane and Stevie, was it Herseth or something? I think he's the guy from Jet. So he gets like a credit on this album. And so yeah, he comes to the fore with that that one note. And that it is really like it is one note, but also he's doing other stuff obviously. But that actually does work perfectly in this song, in that it helps like the guitars sort of bounce around that and sort of interplay with it. It kind of works really well. It's interesting actually.
Yeah, for sure. I know that there were, as you mentioned last week with Dilettantes, that's a kind of like a, yeah, I think you said it's more kind of like art, you know, it's a piece of art and stuff. And I know there were kind of like a lot of intricacies with that record musically and lyrically as well. But I think on this one, it's just captured a little better. And that was just another example where I felt like it stood out and makes the song better. So, all right. So that's track 7, track 8, Pinpricks, baby.
We've missed track 7, actually, The Ocean.
Oh, what am I talking about? Sorry, dude.
You're right.
Track 7, The Ocean.
That's what I'm here for. Yeah, good tune. We continue to build here with the sound. A strong outro again, building on the last track. This outro like goes a bit harder. It's a bit sharper. I'm not sure if you and I have a following within the surfing community, but if there was a surfing chapter of the You and I fan club, I'm guessing that they dig this tune. I don't know what this tune's about, but, you know, it's called The Ocean. You know, I need to feel the ride at the outro lyrics. It sounds, you know, surfing-like. But the song does lose some points for me. There's nothing wrong with the song. But if you haven't noticed, this podcast is not really about you or me. It's all about me. It's free therapy. Now, the oceanic theme of this song takes me back to my high school and uni days of being somewhat upstaged by the surfers. You know, I might be chatting to a lovely lady, imparting an element of charm, at the very least keeping their attention with my, you know, poor man's Jerry Seinfeld routine, probably talking about butterflies or something. And then a surfer would join the conversation, you know, mention his spiritual connection to the ocean. And in a flash, I was yesterday's news. You know, I was fish and chip rapping. No. So I like this song, but I'll be blunt. It's not getting on my podium.
Oh, no. But you need to take it out on the actual surfers. You can't take it out on your favorite band's songs. Come on, mate.
Sorry, boys.
Misdirection. Classic misdirection. But, yeah, no, I'm a big fan of this one. You took the words out of my mouth in terms of the surf community. Surely there has to be some type of I'm just thinking like, yeah, monster waves with slow motion. It's kind of, for me, I think that there is a throwback kind of 90s sound, but
all right,
I guess it just sounds kind of like a big kind of 90s hit for me. Yeah. But so I think Tim's voice sounds exceptional on this particular track. And I saw that there is one, actually it's kind of funny, performance of this song where they're playing at the Annadale Hotel. They just supported someone at a stadium in Sydney, and at the start Tim said, I just want to let everyone know I took a couple trips, and he's tripping, and he said he took one before the stadium show. And then he said he took another one, and he said everyone was dancing like little alligators in the crowd. And then they jumped into this track, and he makes a mistake because, you know, if you recall in this song, there's the after the first, you feel like it's gonna go into the chorus, and then it kind of recedes. It goes back into the second verse. He lets out a big fuck yeah, as in we're about go into the I need to feel the ride thing, and then realizes the rest of the band are just going to play the song as it's intended. And he looks over at Andy and kind of like bites his lip. So anyway, that's why you don't do drugs, kids. But no, it added to it. So if you want some laughs, that's a good one. But big fan of this one. I think this is kind of, just the classic big rocker song on the record.
I know sometimes they do play, I'm talking in Sydney here. I've seen them play at the Narrabeen, you know, RSL, so the Northern Beaches. I wonder if they just open and close with this one, just, you know, playing to the crowd. You know, what are we going to play tonight? The Ocean. What's after that? The Ocean. You know, just to, get the, you want to sort of like frame your set list along the lines of your audience. So I'm thinking that.
I remember when Jay-Z and Kanye West, dead naming. Yeah, when Ye and Jay-Z used to be, I think they were called, it was called Watch the Throne. And after their first album, they did a tour. And I remember reading the set list, or just reading the Pitchfork recap of the set list. And they had a track, one of the singles. It was called N-Words in Paris. And they used to play that song like 8 times in a show. Oh, I'm not sure they got through the entire song each time. Right.
Yeah.
But or they would like stop another song and they just let's play N-Words in Paris again. And then I always thought that that was kind of cool, where it was like, yeah, if you've got a real big rocker and it's hot at the moment, or yeah, there's some type of contextual reason you want to play something, why not play it more than once? It's your song. You can do whatever you want. And I don't know. I think some bands should do that more. So yeah, I agree. Yeah, but yeah, I think this song, yeah, there's the surfing connotations, but it just sounds like this is the driving in your car that's about to go do something naughty tune for me. Right. As I mentioned, the opening track is kind of a headphone song. This is like cruising around in your Ford Fairlane. It's souped up.
The spoiler.
Yeah, exactly. So that's love this it. Track to a T. Big fan. All right. The one I tried to get to before, track 8. Pinpricks.
Yeah, I don't know what the pedal or guitar is being used here, but I like the sound of, I think it's Tim's opening riff. It's sprightly. It's just the slightest hint of industry. You know, keep on pushing when the pinpricks start to bleed. I want to feel once again. You know, it's continuing the theme of having a fresh dig at life. You know, it's energetic and we're still building. So, yeah, it's a good tune, a good linking tune once again.
Yeah, for me, I felt like this was a kind of a real transitional song. Mm. And I think some people will think I'm just trying to rebrand an album track as a transitional song. But I think it's a little pocket rocket that fits in perfectly here. And in terms of the theme, it's funny you mentioned that, like, pop of the industry or like, a fresh start. We've still got something to give. The visual I got was, for me, this just sounds so much like live music in Melbourne, where I've never lived in Melbourne. I've visited many times, and pretty much every time I've visited, I've gone out and seen some live music. Mm-hmm. And there are a few cities in the world where it has the reputation of being an artistic city with a capital A. And Melbourne is one, San Francisco is another, Portland, Oregon is another one, where a lot of people, when they have some sprogs, move out to the suburbs, you know what they do? They stop dancing. They could be ravers in their late teens and their 20s, or they could get into ballroom dancing, whatever it is. But then they get a bit older, they stop dancing. Every time I've gone to Melbourne, I've seen some 40-something bodies on the dance floor really putting it about with no shame or self-consciousness and
respect.
Yeah, something to be admired and respected. I feel like I can just picture them playing this in Melbourne.
Oh, yeah.
40-something bodies flying around without a care in the world.
And that's sort of like, you know, when you see old dancing in the 50s where they had it's a very specific kind of like, movement. I can see this is the song that kind of would, you know, I'm shaking my body here like this is not a visual thing, but that kind of jutting movement,
you know,
I can feel that would be the kind of dance move to Pinpricks.
Yeah, it's a jutting track, defos. All right, we figured that one out. Pinpricks, you're in the bag. Track 9, Waiting to Be Found Out.
Yeah, well, I'm starting to get worried here, Tom, because earlier in the album you said that, you know, this is working here, but later on it doesn't quite work, and I'm starting to get worried that it's coming up soon because this song.
Oh, you know me pretty well. You know me pretty well.
This song, you know, in case you haven't noticed, listeners, I've been talking a lot about how things are building in this record. This is where, in my opinion, we get the payoff. I reckon this corner of the record is absolutely top notch. And this track is a ripper. And I guess if you and I were toying with a new kind of sound over the past couple of records, in my opinion, this is the tune where it hits pay dirt. It's subtle. There's also some bounce and swing. Tim nails the vocal, including some, you know, beaut falsetto wooing. You know, we haven't mentioned it, and it's been remiss of us not to mention after so many eps, but Tim's a great wooer. Think of the Heavy Heart Woos, you know, but this song too. The gentle tumbling guitar intro, Rusty's shimmering contribution, Andy has some nice bass moments. Everyone's bringing something interesting to the table here. And the subject matter is super interesting too. I think maybe we're kind of going back in time a bit. Maybe Tim's jogging the memory from his experiences living in Madrid, I think. I'm just guessing, trying to make sense of it, of how he felt through that time. You know, this might surprise people. It might surprise you, Tommy. But in my mind, this song is right up there with You and My's best ever songs. I'm serious. This is a serious comment. Best ever songs. If that surprises people, I just encourage you to listen to it again. And give it another listen. I love it so much. What do you think?
So, yeah, for me, I love how this track starts. You know, we've got chimes and in the background. So, and with the chimes, I think it gives the effect of, you know, with the chimes and then I guess just the acoustic guitar and the vocal. It just sounds like someone who's kind of spent the night at a hippie chick's house and he's picked up the acoustic guitar the next morning. She's still sleeping or something, or gone out. She's in the veggie patch out of the back and picking the brekkie from patch to table. Yeah, exactly. And he's just picked up an acoustic guitar and he's just letting it all hang out. And he's just vibing and letting his emotions come through his fingers. And so I love how this track begins. I feel like the chorus lets it down though.
Okay.
As I mentioned, it is the opposite of Shuck for me, where I feel like the intro, the verse is really promising, and the way it kind of shut the shuffling kind of beat. But then as soon as it gets to You're Not to Blame, I feel, I don't know, there's something kind of like dark and ominous and uncertain and weird about the beginning. And then I feel like the chorus is, it just doesn't fit somehow. Yeah, okay. So, but to be clear, such a big fan of the beginning and just the verse parts that I still like the track. It doesn't cancel it out, but I just, perhaps I'd classify this as almost like a missed opportunity where it's and this perhaps begs, maybe songwriters can potentially relate to this where that might be the problem with having a very, I guess it's subjective, but if you think you've got a really strong verse, then you might have to sit on a song for years because you're like, well, I can't figure out a chorus that's going to beat this verse. So anyway, that's my minor gripe with this track. I still think it's a good tune, but doesn't live up to my expectations set by the intro.
There you go. This is why this podcast is fun to do. There's a bit of conflict, a bit of, you know, tit for tat. This is what this podcast has needed for the last 8 episodes. We've just been agreeing too much, but I totally understand where you're coming from. And I it works for me. Everything works for me nicely. Like the build up to the chorus, into the chorus, you know, the build up, that's where Andy sort of comes into his own. And then, I guess in my mind, the subject matter is Tim is kind of looking back to his time, I guess. It's just my understanding of it, might be wrong, but his time living in Madrid and his, you know, his old relationships and trying to work stuff out. So it kind of makes sense to me. Understand. Oh, good.
All right, we got there. We didn't come to blows over Skype. That was pretty civil. All right, track 10, Trigger Finger, baby. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Look, I mentioned earlier that my take on the way You and My generally sequence their albums is that they put either their best song or the most rocking song or the song they think is most emblematic of the record as the second track. So for me, Trigger Finger is a song I think of when I think of this record. It's the song I think of, actually. It's one of the best tracks on the record, so it could definitely be a candidate for the second track placement. I wonder if they considered it, but maybe if you put it there, you might not have the layering effect, the building effect I've mentioned so much. So it's no criticism from me. I like it here. It's part of what I consider the album's purple patch, and it sits ideally between Waiting to Be Found Out and Let's Not Get Famous. But here, Andy Kent is the star of this track. I remember hearing Tim mention in an interview that it was Andy that suggested that they should get rid of the guitars from the intro and just lead with the bass, and it works brilliantly. The bass also helps Davey's excellent guitar solo go to another level. It's a super performance from a bass guitarist, and also an extra excellent contribution from Lainey Lane, who was a bit of an indie country darling, I guess, for a minute or two. But then she kind of said, "This is all bullshit. I'm out of here." Which
yeah,
you've got
I saw
to respect.
That Wiki. Yeah.
I've got a bit from Wiki here. It said, in 2015, Lane announced she's quitting the music industry indefinitely, admitting the rock and roll lifestyle is no longer for me. In a lengthy statement, Lane said that her love of creating, writing, and playing music is still a true joy, but the ambition for fame and attention in the industry is completely gone.
Mm. Good on her.
Good on her, yeah.
That's rare. Not many people do that. They burn out or fade away.
It takes huge. People sometimes like decades to realize, hang on, this is all bullshit.
Yeah, no, Lainey's a smart lady, it seems.
Yeah. What do you think?
First of all, I want to ask you a question. You mentioned, I think it was our very first ep or one of the first eps, you said you shared the embarrassing moment of getting caught by your father when you were kind of doing a wild solo to, was it Forever and Easy? And
It was Rhythm Guitar, but yeah.
Yeah. let's get the facts straight. But I was just wondering, was that more embarrassing, or was it more embarrassing when you got caught by your girlfriend belting out, "You ain't easy"? Because folks,
you know, I do that.
That has happened to John O'Duncan. Come on, you haven't admitted it to me, but I just know for a fact that must have happened. You've got the AirPods on. Maybe you're doing a bit of gardening yourself. You're in the veggie patch. You've belted it out, only to notice there's a shadow over you. It's your girlfriend, and you're wondering, will she ever look at me in the same way?
This happens all the time. A little anecdote. I was having lunch with a couple of people the other day, and I was saying that I don't really like musicals, like in that I've liked a couple recently, but in general, I've always been of the opinion that I don't like them, which is ridiculous because, you know, you shouldn't just box things in. But anyway, my thought was, it's just not real. People just don't go around their daily lives and then just jump into song. And then my sister who was there, she was like, "That's exactly what you do. You just live your life and start singing." And so, yeah, I'm always doing this, and I'm always going for the backing vocal or the high-pitched vocal. So this has happened to me dozens of times, and You Ain't Easy is a beautiful, fun part to sing. I mean, I'm kind of like the 40-somethings who in Melbourne who start dancing when they get older. Like, I never danced or sung as like a teen or a 20-something. I was very much like a kind of reserved character, but I've actually discovered dancing and singing to myself, but it's actually very liberating, and I love it. And the way I discovered dancing was really just to get through weddings. I discovered that if you're not dancing, it's a long night. So then I just started dancing, and weddings are fun now. So, but anyway, yes, I have been caught in those scenarios many, many occasions, and it's no longer embarrassing.
Yeah, well, there you go, folks. I knew it had happened, and he's came out and said it. So, no, I'm a big fan. I echo all your sentiments about this track. A few things that spring to mind. The lyric, "Walked for 16 miles fresh off the rack to shake this grist out of my mind, but I got this damn trigger finger, keeps me wired all of the time." If you've read the Holy Book of Detours, you know Tim likes to walk. He's got into the nose nonsense in the past. And so, 16 mile walk is something that you get lots of cocaine songs, or maybe like the anticipation of cocaine. You don't get many post cocaine tunes. And so this directly, I guess, addresses that. And I like just the way the call and response, or the duet, the way the duet works. When he says "easy come, easy go," and then she says "you ain't easy," the lovely Lainey Lane. It reminded me of this again, we're making it about ourselves here, but forgive me. At this 21st birthday, at a friend of mine, he's potentially one of the most type A people I know. Irresponsible, very fun guy, but just kind of like likes to get things done. He was the head boy at my high school, right. Studying medicine at the time, and with the party or whatever it was. And one of our mates gave him a speech at his 21st. And he was like, mate, you're a stand-up guy. Everything makes sense with you. You know, everything's on brand. Like you get what you see, and you're kind of like, you're a man of your word, except for your car. He had this car, and on the back he had a bumper sticker where it was like, it had the acronym DILIGAF, Do I Look Like I Give a Fuck? And oh, I think that was because he's tangentially, I think it's his godfather actually, is Kevin Bloody Wilson, you know, the Australian, the Bawdy, which I think is one of his songs. So anyway, he got given a few bumper stickers for Christmas, and he threw it on the back of his car. And my buddy, when he was doing the 21st speech, kind of like really nice speech, but they rounded it off, was like, yeah, mate, you do give a fuck. That's the one thing, you do give a fuck. So anyway, that was the 21st birthday speeches. At the time, you think, oh, you crushed it, mate. That was really good. Years looking back, you're like, they all sucked. But there was a couple moments that really stuck with me, and that was one. My buddy Luke crushed that particular speech. But
that is great.
Yeah, in this track, it seems like easy come, easy go. And then she's like, no, you ain't easy. Reminds me of the DILIGAF speech. Which hopefully I've implanted in your brain that you'll think of forever when you play this track. But I do have to say, I'm going to agree with you. It's a great track. However, we mentioned on the prior track, Chimes. Chimes are working well on track 9. But I feel like the Chimes aren't doing it for me on Trigger Finger, I'm afraid. And you know what it is? Because I think on track 9, the Chimes, they kind of, as I said, the Hippie Chicks living room, it has a wind chime effect. It's like a random chiming. Whereas this one, I feel like I've walked into a massage parlor. It's kind of like a door opening chime. Do you know what I mean? It's too predictable, the chiming effect. So anyway, I feel like I'm a dive, you know, at the Olympics when people dive and then you're taking off like a 0.3 because it was a little splash. His ankle came in weird. I can't mark it down too much from a chime, but in the spirit of honesty and integrity and our favorite word, authenticity, I think I need to mention that the chime, too much of a restaurant, walking into a restaurant or a massage pile. Why? It's me and this
Tommy Waite, the Belarusian judge, yes, here on the podcast.
Exactly. Is he corrupt? He's wearing two Rolexes. What's he 9. Doing?
4. What? Yeah. I haven't noticed the chimes on this particular track. I think you said something earlier. I think it was Crime where they didn't have drums in the first half of the album. I didn't even notice that either. So, like, I'm not – it shows that how little I really pay attention to drums, which I feel bad because Rusty is just such an amazing drummer. We've spoken about Rusty ad nauseum, especially early on in this series as well. But just on Rusty, just a bit of a side note, I got a message on Saturday night from my cousin who said – he sent me a link saying, UMI drummer passes out during show. I'm like, what the hell? Yeah, and it was rushed to hospital or something. And apparently Rusty got heat stroke playing at a festival at Centennial Park on Saturday. And I was like, I was in Sydney. I live in Sydney. And I was like, wasn't that hot? Is he okay? I was a bit worried. But it was, you know, it was one of those days. It was warm in the sun, I guess. And then I read in the article that he was playing the outro to Apple Cross Wind Commander. I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
There we go. Yeah, yeah.
And apparently he's fine, so.
All right. That's good news.
Do you still hold that chime criticism, Tom, now that you know he's been in hospital?
No. Dude, the way I feel like the worst person in the world now, but are you going to tell me that it was Rusty playing the chime? He insisted that they do it. I think that was just a yes, it's fitting. Trigger finger. The chime worked so well on track 9. They were like, throw it in, throw it in. And so that's why they went for track 10. But anyway, that's track 10. Last track of the record. Let's not get famous.
Let's not get famous. So, you know, we talked about Lainey Lane's, you know, position that she said, this is all a bit bullshit, this fame thing. It kind of leads nicely into Let's Not Get Famous. Another beauty from this corner of the album, in my opinion. You know, a common theme we've spoken about throughout this series, Tommy, has been how You're My Rose to Prominence earned a decent level of popularity and then kind of saw it gradually and naturally wane a bit. And we speculated on how that might have felt for the band and how they framed that whole experience in their mind. Well, I reckon this song goes a long way to explaining it. I think there's very much a vibe of, you know, life's short. We're so lucky to be able to make records and travel around the world, and let's enjoy what we have. More than that, though, Let's Not Get Famous Yet. Is it maybe an acknowledgement that, yeah, it all came pretty quick early on and that maybe they didn't handle it perfectly, and that's kind of all worked out for them in the end, the way it's all kind of unfolded. You know, maybe there's an element of retrospective justification, but there's also a lot of truth to it. And, you know, they've had an amazing ride and they're in a pretty good place. So, yeah, I love the space in this song. It sounds like it's recorded on a winter's day. You know, the keys are sort of cutting through the brisk air. It's a beautiful track, in my opinion. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great way to close it out. Again, yeah, just reading Tim's book gives you so much more context in terms of like their career trajectory, his experience being in the band. And, you know, there's some lines in this song where it's like, let's go to bed when we're tired or something. Like, it's just in terms of kind of like doing your job and being happy with it. And we're here for a sweet time, not a long time.
Yeah.
Let's have some fun. So I think doesn't blow me away, but I think the right track to end this album. And I would agree. I think it kind of, as you mentioned, in terms of the build of the album to end with these last three tracks, I can kind of see what they were doing here. So I like this one to close things out.
Yeah, well, you said we're closing this out, but there is another track. So
True. I was actually going to ask you about that. Is that considered a hidden track?
Well, I always considered it. I always thought it was a hidden track, but I'm looking at the CD cover at the moment, and it says track 12 right this time. So I don't know why I thought it was a hidden track. Maybe like the way it sort of happens on the stereo or something. I've got no idea. But here it says track 12 right this time, which is
I was confused by it as well, because like on my Apple Music it was playing as the 12th track, but then on every other platform and on Wiki it just closed it out on track 11. So I was like, I've got some type of additional version here. So
I'm wondering, this is why you're
the super fan.
I'm racking my brain. I wonder if like the early release gave you this extra track, maybe. I've got a feeling like you got kind of like a bonus track, maybe, that that the early sort of sales gave. But yeah, the album proper, it ends on Let's Not Get Famous. Maybe. I'm racking my brain. That sounds familiar. But anyway, we should talk about the track.
And I was afraid to bring it up because I recall when we did the Owly Daily episode and I was like, I want to talk about opportunities in Trike, and I could just sense you being like, come on mate, that's not the real record. He lives in America now, he thinks he can talk about the international Japanese versions. Who does this bloke think he is? So I was genuinely shaking in my boots to bring it up, so please talk about it.
If this is the end of the album, it's kind of similar to the end of Convicts. You know, it's a familiar You Are My sound, but sounds nothing like the rest of the record. You know, it's a cool, bouncy track. And like with what we said at the end of Convicts, they're mostly saying, or they're kind of saying, I guess, hey, guys, don't freak out too much. We're still here. We can still bounce. Don't stress. Mm. You know, chillax. Yeah, so when I was kind of thinking about this track over the last couple of days, I was thinking, because, yeah, on my CD casing, it's not a hidden track. And I was thinking it actually would work better as a hidden track, because Let's Not Get Famous feels like a perfect finish to the album. And I guess that's what actually how it is, as if they kind of were putting it forward as a piece of art. It finishes with Let's Not Get Famous. But maybe there's like there is a link to Let's Not Get Famous, because it's kind of saying, yeah, maybe we didn't handle things like we should have in the past, but let's do it right this time. There is kind of a thematic thread between Let's Not Get Famous and Right This Time. So either way, whether it's part of the album proper or a hidden track or just a bonus track, it's a cool tune. And I particularly like Davey's solo here, which kind of starts as a kind of repetitive notes and then kind of spills out. I think it's a great little effect.
Yeah, I didn't prepare anything specifically because I was a little afraid of what Jono's reaction was going to be in case I brought it up and I wasn't meant to. But I would agree with everything you said. And the comparison to I'm a Mess is a good a good one. In that, yeah, just kind of the sound. And it's almost like you could see it as a choose your own adventure. If you're happy to end on the kind of somber, poignant, Let's Not Get Famous side of things, you could leave it there. Or kind of like, yeah, let's have a mid-tempo rocker to, you know, as a palate cleanser almost.
Yeah, I like that.
To start again. So maybe that's what they've done here on this, what are we calling it? Australia or Australia. Something else? Yeah, all right. Well, I think we pretty much did it. So I guess I'm trying to think about what we can talk about. We saw myself and Jono Duncan, this album came out when we were working together at an office that shall not be named. And we went and saw the show at Metro Theatre, Sydney, in support of this album. Do you remember too much from that show? I only remember bits and pieces.
Yeah, not much. I remember actually we were standing in the back. I think it was one of those times where I realized I just want to go with people who like UMI. I'm not going to bring non-UMI people to shows anymore, because like I remember I think I was out with a bunch of friends, you know, I think watching the footy or something, or there was maybe grand final or AFL grand final or something. And I was going to UMI that night with yourself, and then like they heard.
Oh yeah, you brought some tag alongs, didn't you?
Yeah, and they kind of ruined it for me. They ruined it for me. They were talking throughout, and then at the end they're like, "Oh, it wasn't really what I expected." Like you were talking throughout, you know, like you didn't even see it. You were pissed. And we're standing at the back, so it's not my favorite memory of a UMI gig, but I do remember some parts of it, including I think. My memory is Laney Lane came out to sing on Trigger Finger, I think. But, yeah, the new song sounded good. That's my memory.
Yeah, and I've went to a couple shows at that room. That's a good room, I guess a medium-sized room, great for rock music. I think we saw Built to Spill there as well back in the day. But, yeah, that was – and I guess this kind of period in the band's – as you said, this came out and then it was like 5 years between the next UMI album. And I think that like this is about to be like when Tim gets involved with the Bamboos and kind of like the TV show stuff and the, I guess, the musical stuff and all that is kind of about to begin, right, around this period.
Yeah. I think the Bamboos was towards when Porridge and Hot Sauce came out. So it's kind of towards the end of that period. But yeah, I think he starts, you know, dipping his toe in some other stuff. And I guess at this point in time, I think UMI, this particular album, from my memory of the wiki page, it was their lowest sort of debut charting album of their history. So it was kind of like we've done what we think is a great piece of work, and they kind of understand where they're at. And so they don't feel the urge. This is my feeling. They don't feel the urge to kind of get back in the studio just for the sake of it. They'll do other stuff, and they'll from this point on, they'll do it when they're ready on their terms and not have to play any games. It's just kind of, do you want to, you know, do we feel like doing it? Do we want to hang out? Let's do it. So that's, I guess this is the end of the band as we kind of know it, in a way, because of the band as a kind of going concern, as being part of the scene, you know, trying to put out records every couple of years and sort of remaining relevant. And so from this point forward, it's kind of like they're still a band, but it's they're not part of the scene. They'll dip in when and how they want. And I think, you know, I listened to this record a few times this week, and let me tell you, a couple of times this record really hit me in the sweet spot and made absolute sense. A couple of times it didn't quite, but when it did, it was really powerful, and it was a brilliant album experience. And like I said with Dilettantes, like a felt really a piece of art. And I can definitely imagine them thinking and understand them saying, you know, upon making this record, that this shits all over our early stuff. I can imagine the creators of an album like this justifiably thinking that this shits on creations of their earlier lives. You know, I get it. I also get people not getting into it and just wanting to listen to Number Four, you know, each to their own. Music's weird and all that sort of stuff. But I reckon it's an album, if you give it the time, it will reward you. And the second half of the album is close to as good as it gets for me.
Yeah, I think the problem with bands as they get deeper into their career is that you only get to make a first impression once. And so if you've got some really great early records, then if it's still the same guys in the band and still the same singer, I don't care how much genre swapping or jumping around you do, you're still going to sound like an iteration of what you've done before. And you could still think it's better, but you're just going to be competing against people who've heard your tracks in the past. So I think that, yeah, there has to be an acceptance of that. And I feel like definitely with each of the UMI albums, Tim Rogers bought kind of like songs with a different flavor and stuff going on. And I'm kind of, yeah, we'll get to our gold, silver, bronze soon here. But yeah, I actually think it's kind of a consistent album. You seem to be kind of leading towards the back end, but I'm a big fan of the start of this one as well. So, before we get into the gold, silver, bronze, I know for a fact, because it was when I was living in Sydney, this is around when Tim was doing the he did that kind of like white album tribute with Phil Jamison and
Chris Cheney,
yeah, who else was there? And one other dude, Josh Pike, I think it was. Old Josh, the middle of the hill guy. What did you see that one or any of the Rolling Stones one? Like, can you give it, what was the white album one like?
Yeah, that was pretty good. Like, I saw a matinee version of that. Yeah, so you know, they all came out. I think individually they play with like one of those bands. It's kind of like the band that would play for John Farnham. You know, like really accomplished musicians, professional musicians. So it's not quite the same though as like a rock band. You know, there's not that looseness from my memory. But yeah, I think my memory of it was that Tim, you know, did his thing and sort of, I think he was given or chose like the weirder songs, so he didn't sort of get many of the hits that people sung along to. So, but he made up for that with his like performance, and I think that the crowd appreciated his efforts. That's my memory of it.
Yeah, I guess almost kind of like at the opposite of Laney Lane around this period, and I think it was actually an interview after he did a Bamboos performance, but Tim Rogers was like, yeah, I just want to get on stage every night. And he seems to, whether it's out of necessity or kind of like running away from his demons, whatever, whatever the reason, it was kind of, it's kind of inspiring when someone's just like, no, I am a performer. This is what I'm doing. And, you know, there's another part in his book where he talks about passing through some American city where he's, I'm not sure if he was on tour or visiting someone, but he bumps into a guy from an American band from the 90s. And they went out for drinks or a beer, dinner together. And the guy was like, just asking me questions like, how are you still making a living at this? And because this, you know, this guy had got a real job or got into academia or something. And so, yeah, I think that, like, for me, kind of like, I guess this is kind of like a signal of, like, I guess, like, Tim branching off even more from the band. And, like, even though he had his kind of like solo work prior to this record, but I think at this point he was kind of like, well, I can kind of like, my band, there's not the obligation of a major record label or expectation to crank out a record every 2 years. I can kind of like pursue weird stuff and just go in every direction.
And also, like, I guess there's an element of, yeah, he's got to work, he's got to make a living. Like one kind of insight I found, or one light bulb moment at one of the gigs, I think I mentioned last time when he debuted the Dilettante song at a solo Annandale gig. And that made me realize when he was sort of talking about, you know, trying to pay the rent and stuff. I'm like, yeah, like, he's probably among the lowest paid people in this audience. It kind of got me thinking, like, oh, yeah, of course. Like, it's hard being an artist. And so, yeah, I guess in his instance, he's got to work. He's got to keep working. And I guess in an ideal world, it'd be, you know, his own creations. But it's, if you got to sort of do other stuff, then it's not so bad. If it's like singing Beatles songs or singing Stones songs, that's not such a bad way to earn a buck as well. So there are definitely worse ways. So I think it's just like, sometimes you just got to do some work. Yeah.
For sure.
And that's fine.
All right, let's do our gold, silver, bronze for this this record to close things out.
Yeah, well, as you know, listeners, I've been pretty fond of the way this album builds, and I reckon the second half is the crescendo. And for me, I'm going basically at that purple patch that I mentioned. So it's number 3, Let's Not Get Famous, number 2, Silver, Trigger Finger, and number 1, Gold, Waiting to Be Found Out. So kind of a backwards maneuver there on those 3 tracks.
Chimes. You're going to pick up the chimes, mate. There's a little...
the chimes vanilla.
Beautiful. All right. I'm going to kind of go the opposite. I'm going bronze, Kicking the Balustrade, silver, right. We Hardly Knew You, gold, The Ocean.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And what, like, you know how I said before that I can picture the band sort of saying, like, listening to this thing that they've created and saying, how can anyone, like, want to listen to Kathy's Clown instead of this kind of thing? Or, you know what I mean? Like, this shit's over their early stuff. Do you see where I'm coming from when I'm saying that?
Yeah, for sure. Because it's, I guess, more sophisticated and more complex music. Yeah. But I think that's, I think this is something that, like, Lou Reed talked about, where he was like, I'm going to make essentially like a literary version of rock music.
Yeah.
But, and so I think a few people kind of appreciated that pastiche where he's like, oh, he's bringing seriousness to this like bubblegum pop thing that's designed to kind of make teenagers fork out there. But there's only like a few Lou Reeds who can be successful. Like, most people want the processed, you know, where industry approved,
Yeah.
This is kind of like pop rock music for young people, played by young people who look fashionable at the time. Definitely, I think you can. I guess both creatures live within me, right? Is that sometimes just a Ramones 2-minute power pop song will do it for me. Other times I'm like, no, let's do this. Let's listen to some weird techno minimalist weird bullshit that's going to I'm going to have to think about and stay with. But I think you'll also just be like, yeah, recency bias. Like if they've just put out this album, they put all this work into it, they probably don't remember what they were actually going for, the work it took to do the old one. So I think that happens a lot with artists.
Yeah, and I think that's happening with me as well, like recency bias of this being the most recent album I've been listening to, and I really got into it this week, and at times I've been like, yeah, this is amazing, and it kind of puts the others in the shade. But then, yeah, the next minute I'll be like, I wouldn't mind listening to number four. So yeah.
Yeah. There's a strange thing in that, like, the older you get, the more proficient you get at your craft, but you're maybe just kind of like playing a different game than what other people expect you to play. So I guess that's the dance of expectations, your internal expectations and external expectations. So anyway, that's the self-titled in the bag.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so folks, the Twitter hasn't capitulated yet as a platform. So Jono's manning the ship over there. Send us your gold, silver, and bronze for this, or you can do it on YouTube, or you can send us an email. You can find the email address in our episode description. But that pretty much covers it. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be a while between drinks because we're recording this in early December. I'm going to be back in Australia, but I'll be in Perth doing the Christmas shenanigans. I'm not sure when we'll get to record the next episode, but stay tuned. We will get to the next two to complete this discography.
Yeah, I'm excited about the next two too, because this is where Davey Lane contributes a couple of songs per album for the next two albums, and he makes his appearance as a songwriter. So that's a really nice contribution and a nice touch to the next couple of albums. So looking forward to that. Enjoy your trip to Perth, mate. I hope it all goes well.
Yeah,
we'll
do.
We'll see you next time.
Yeah, and just quickly, I think I mentioned on the Deliverance episode, I was like, this is by far and away the UMI album I've listened to the least. And that was a bold-faced lie, because it's definitely the last two. Like, Porridge and Hot Sauce and The Lives of Others, I've had them on like once or twice, but it's been like not paying attention. I know the and so it's going to be great for me to kind of actually like listen properly and kind of get – it's kind of exciting because I'll get these – properly for the first time. All right, well, stay tuned, folks. Thanks for listening, and Jono, catch you on the next one.
See you, folks.